What I'd like you to do, if you could, is start out by, first of all, giving me personal background, you know, where you went to school, mm-hmm. where you're originally from, how you came to Michigan State, how you came to be in the University College, and then take it from there as to how it developed with your involvement.
Well, I had both my bachelor's and master's degrees from Bowling Green. Mm-hmm. I had bounced around 5 different colleges as an undergraduate. You could do that on the GI Bill in those days. It was very nice, from coast to coast. Wound up at Bowling Green, where I met a professor who was very, very influential. His name was Emerson Schuck. Stayed there and got my master's in English, and then went back in the Army for the Korean War, and when I got out, Schuck told me to come to Michigan State and get my degree under a friend of his, Russell Nye, who was still active, incidentally, so I did. And as I was finishing up my coursework, I needed a job, and Russ said, I'll call the head of what was then Communication Skills. So this was 1957, I started working full-time in what was Communication Skills. I had no intention of staying, but 2 years down the line, we began the conversion, which incidentally was largely Ed Carlin's idea, to a subject matter-based composition course, and subject matter would be American thought.
Now, what year is this?
This was, we began to the transition in 1959,
okay.
And the new course came into existence in 1960.
When did it change from basic college to university college?
That was about the same time, give or take a year, mm-hmm. maybe 61, 62, I don't know. I could probably figure it out. To go look at some of the back issues of the quarterly. Do you know the University yes. College Quarterly?
Yes, I've been digging articles out of it left and right, and I went back as far as 57, I think. But don't hold me to that. I just haven't found.
Well, these,
what was the first volume? That's the first year for it.
Oh, It began as a basic college quarterly. And then
I'll look up Thursday when I get back from.
But anyway, it was probably 61, 62, something in there. Well, I came over with no intention of staying. I had no desire to stay here, for one thing. And then I got involved in the transition to the new course, developing the new course, and I was very excited about it. As some of the rest of us were, others weren't. Others were very upset because the speech dimension was going, and they were committed to that, but we did put together what I thought was truly a great course. I still think it was a great course. It was a common course, as all the university college courses then were, and it was a chronological examination of major American ideas through original documents, beginning with the 17th century and on up into the 1950s mm-hmm. then. And it was a very comprehensive course. It was a very demanding course, a difficult course to teach, and the kids respected it, and they liked it. In fact, one of the things that always amused me about it and pleased me about it was that the kinds of things that they were doing would turn up in their daily conversation or their letters to the editor or what have you. And so they had a common discourse, common context, and this was one of the objectives of the university college from the beginning. And so I stayed and got involved in so many things that I simply stayed here and been here ever since. But the original course, as I said, have you seen any of the old syllabi or anything like that?
No, not the ones from the original. I remember reading about some of it. The listening course, which I found intriguing.
Oh, no, that was gone.
That was in your basic college. And what I found intriguing about it is that one of the things that they've built into the standards for education in Ohio now is learning how to listen.
Well,
and I never
learned how to teach how to listen.
Anyway. Well, I found it interesting that they were thinking of that in 46.
Yeah. Well, that was the old communication skills philosophy, was that there were 4 communication skills: speaking, listening, reading, and writing. And presumably, of course, they were interrelated, and one had to master the four of them rather than one individually. But
I thought it was a little
The problem with communication skills, among other problems, was the fact that it had no intellectual substance, mm-hmm. and the kids didn't respect it.
It was called
comical skills. It was known as a Mickey Mouse course. And it was. It was. Mm-hmm. There's no question about it. And I would not have stayed if that had continued. But then this is why we built a course that had considerable intellectual substance, and it was a rigorous course, a demanding course. And they learned very quickly to respect it, and as did the faculty. A number of faculty left. They simply wanted no part of the new course. Many of them were not prepared to teach it in the first place. But it caught on, and the course was, again, I think a good course, a substantial course, and something that nobody else was doing, and that is teaching them something about the American heritage. In humanities, they were learning about essentially the Western European tradition, but they were doing nothing with America. Nobody was doing anything with America. And consequently, of course, this did, I think, fill a gap that had been present for a long time and that badly needed filling. And then, too, of course, it was, as I said, a common course, so we had agreement on the major ideas that would be explored by all the students. And consequently, they had a common discourse, a common context. And this continued, the common course continued with some variations here and there, changes in emphasis, changes in curriculum, changes in some of the readings, changes in texts, with the same basic philosophy and the same emphasis on major ideas, until the late 60s, when more and more agitation began, both in and outside of the department, to vary it. And of course, this was the time when the emphasis began including more material, particularly by minorities, particularly by blacks. And many of the anthologies didn't have much. Well, at that point, I was chairman of the curriculum committee and edited a book of readings called The Black Experience to supplement what we were doing in the regular text. And this worked out pretty well. I think it was a good collection of readings, and it did certainly explore the black experience in America as well. And it remained a chronological approach. Well, the late 60s and early 70s saw the movement in the direction of tracks. One of the first tracts was a minorities track, which explored major minority writers. And another early track was the women's track, exploring largely feminist ideas. And then there was a radical thought track, an American humanities track, and abomination of abominations, an American film track. Well, what happened? I think this is really the beginning of the end. This was being paralleled, incidentally, by both the Department of Social Science and the Department of Humanities. They were going in the direction of various tracks, too. And I think that was really the beginning of the end, because we lost the common focus. We lost the sense of a common enterprise. And in fact, more and more people began to think of what they were teaching as theirs, as opposed to yours. You're teaching your course, I'm teaching my course. And so, of course, the idea of a common enterprise and a common project and a common course simply went out the window.
So the old bugaboo tradition.
And I thought it was a mistake then, and I still think it was a mistake, because almost immediately after the tracks came into existence, well, there were certain guidelines. The tracks were supposed to parallel each other. All of them would be taught chronologically. And then also, and most importantly, an individual was supposed to be able to move from one track to the other without being penalized in any way.
Well, so I can do that.
But, well, they're covering the same material, essentially, from different perspectives.
Okay.
You would get a black perspective, let's say, on slavery from Frederick Douglass and others, mm-hmm. instead of a white perspective by Abraham Lincoln. Or he would get something of both. But increasingly, they began to drift away from this. They began to drift away from the chronological sequence, which meant that one student in the first term might be reading about the 18th century, and his roommate may be reading about the 20th century, losing the common discourse, the common context. And the film was largely to blame for this.
Who, within the university college, if you were to group them, who were the ones that were basically pushing towards the tracks?
They were specialists. They were mostly specialists.
Were they old-timers such as yourself?
They were mostly newcomers who didn't, relatively newcomers, I should say, who didn't like to think of themselves as generalists. They wanted to think of themselves as specialists. They came in, presumably, as generalists, but instead of adapting to the nature of the department, they started demanding change. And, a number of things also happened at the same time. Of course, this was the 60s and the early 70s when students were making their desires and their prejudices and their opinions known vocally and marching around shouting on strike, burn it down, and things like that. And I think a number of people went overboard in trying to make the material relevant. That was the key word. And so, of course, the tracks took the relevancy bit in their mouths and ran off with it in all directions. And from that point on, I think we lost one of the basic elements that's crucial in general education. That's the commonality.
I've heard that from professors inside the department, outside the department, administrators inside and out. Mm-hmm. I also heard from an administrator on the outside that during the 70s, and he didn't specify where, but in the 70s, that there was a movement for a faculty union and that the firebrands were within the university college. Was that true?
Somewhere. There weren't all that many firebrands. There were two faculty votes on whether or not to unionize, as I remember. Both were overwhelmingly defeated. I would say that there were half a dozen very, very vocal supporters of unionization across the campus. Oh, there were a fair number of not so vocal supporters, but by and large, there was, from the very beginning, a pretty strong no union attitude throughout not only University College but elsewhere. There were two or three very vocal and active pro-union people in University College, and some of them made some unfortunate remarks publicly, which didn't do the cause any good. But anyway,
I'm wondering about that because I was wondering if that might have been one of many factors involved.
Well, there were a lot of hard feelings on both sides, mostly pro-union and the anti-union side. I don't really think that had any bearing on the demise of the college. There were a couple of individuals in the college who made a lot of enemies for themselves on both sides of the issue, as a matter of fact, who probably weren't working hard enough, so they had too much leisure in their head.
Too radical.
But anyway, I don't think that had any real bearing. I think, by and large, the thing that made it easy to divide the college was this movement toward tracks, because people began to think of them as their courses.
They lost their focus.
And they lost their focus, they lost their sense of commonality, a lot of colleagueship, a lot of the sense of a common cause went out the window. And this led to some well, in much of the 80s, actually, or not 80s, much of the 70s, what am I saying? There was a lot of conflict and acrimony and name-calling within the college as a result of this. And by and large, there were a number of people who were going to reshape the college in any one of a number of directions. You take your pick. And that didn't do it any good. I think in the background, well, of course, while Hannah was president, Hannah was very, very strongly supportive of the University College, and the people he appointed to administrative offices were highly supportive. And including the, let's see, Hannah's last, I'm trying to think, John Cantlin was provost, and then Cantlin, if I remember correctly, was followed by Larry Boger.
Well, Dr. Hannah left in 69, and,
yeah,
and Neville was with him time as provost.
Yeah, yeah, Neville.
He left shortly thereafter.
And then Cantlin became provost. And then Cantlin was always very supportive. And then Larry Boger, who had been dean of agriculture, became provost. He was quite supportive. In fact, Larry Boger was brought out of agriculture to become provost when the assistant provost had expected to get the job, but he didn't get it. Larry was appointed over him. But then when Larry left to become president of Oklahoma State, Lee Winder, who was the assistant chairman, became provost. And Lee had never had any use for the University College. And I think he was just, in many ways, just sitting there waiting for his opportunity to do it in. Well, meanwhile, Ed Carlin was getting older, was not in good health. And Ed probably should have stepped down. I never would have said that to him, but he probably should have, because his health was not good. And consequently, somebody with a little more vigor might have been able to fight off the barbarians at the gates. But anyway, Ed left the deanship after a lot of hassling with some of these people who wanted to take the college in all kinds of directions. He finally left the deanship. And at that time, Ed Hardin was acting president. And Hardin, with all due respect, Hardin was a disaster for this university. He was supposed to have all kinds of good contacts in the legislature. He was going to get us all kinds of money during his tenure, so he didn't pay any attention to what was going on campus. Turned everything, particularly from the academic side, over to Lee Winder. We can just predict what Winder's agenda was going to be. And as Ed left the deanship, this was when Winder made up his mind that he was going to do in the University College. In fact, I think he was waiting for Ed to leave. So it was abolished, literally, by administrative fiat. There was never a faculty vote, never any kind of review process or anything of the sort. Lee just declared that
that's what Dr. Thompson told
no longer in existence.
He said 1 minute it was going along, next minute, boom, it was gone. And he,
yeah, we were under, we had a search procedure underway for the new dean, and he suddenly announced that it was gone. And Bill Warrington, whom you'll talk to, was acting dean at the time. And Hardin, of course, never made a pronouncement of any kind. That was not his bag. He didn't care what was going on.
How was President Wharton when he was president?
Wharton was very supportive. Wharton, I enjoyed working for and with Wharton. He was very, there were a lot of people who didn't like him, but I thought he was first grade. Very much concerned with the intellectual life of the university and the cultural life of the university. And that to me was welcome. Because
yeah.
Hannah never really was. Hannah supported these things, but they weren't part of his major interest or part of his major agenda for the university. But when Wharton came, it was part of Wharton's agenda, and he wanted to develop the cultural and intellectual dimension of the university, and he did. And His wife was very active, and she was on the board of NEA at the time, and so we had good contacts with NEA,
I'm looking forward to meeting him. I've got an appointment scheduled in July with him.
Oh, good.
He's been very agreeable.
I was running a thing called the Office of Faculty Development then, and we put on workshops for grantsmanship and this sort of thing, editorship publications, and bring people in from all over. And Wharton just delighted in it. And we had a program, we're developing a program to emphasize and to provide an opportunity for more international, more of an international focus in courses all across the campus, including American Foreign Language. And this was run by a group called the Humanities Coordinating Committee, which I was chairman. It was a joint project of international programs, arts and letters, and university college. And I think we had some pretty good successes. We got a couple of good grants and did contribute to broadening and further developing curriculum across the campus. And Wharton, as I said, was very, very supportive. Again, Hardin wasn't interested in anything. And I think that more than anything else. Plus, there were people in the university college who welcomed it. There were people who were firmly convinced that somehow teaching freshmen and sophomores is second rate. You're not a real academic unless you teach graduate students.
That's what Dr. Cantman indicated to me, that there was, in essence, two separate cultures here.
Mm-hmm.
The general teacher, professors mm-hmm. at the general college and the rest basically weren't considered themselves two separate cultures. One was pro-scholarship, the other was pro-teaching.
No, I don't think that's quite true.
I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah, it's not quite true.
I took 15 minutes of discussion and zipped it into 30 seconds.
Because the University College has always had a very, very strong scholarly dimension. A lot of good scholarship has come out of
I liked what I saw in the quarterly. It was very well written quarterly.
And got a lot of good specialist stuff came out of Manny Hackle, primary blood chemist in the country. Still a generalist, and lots of others. But there were those both increasing numbers in the college, new people who come in, and lots outside the college who were firmly convinced that to be a generalist is by definition to be second rate. And so those in the college were trying to move into the mainstream disciplines. And some of those outside the college were convinced that since it's second rate, it must go. And these were the people who, when Winder gave them their head in one way or another, really did it in. And did in the college, and then, of course, began to snipe at the departments. Now ATL is the only one of the three of the four departments still in existence.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason it's still in existence is because nobody else wants to carry home the stacks of papers and grade them.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we carry the burden, English doesn't have to do it. That's the only thing that saves it right now.
There's two things I wanted to ask you. One was, what has happened to the general kids with no preference? There used to be this.
Well,
university college was a perfect haven for the young man or young lady who came in knowing they wanted a college degree, but really, maybe they were like myself, pushed one way by their parents, but not really knowing that's what they wanted.
Yeah.
And then they got here and they said, wait a minute, this isn't really for me. I came in pro-engineering because my cousin was an engineer, my father wanted me to be an engineer. Well, I got here and realized that that wasn't for me. I didn't like the engineers I met. I just didn't feel comfortable around them. I felt more like a mathematician.
Well, this is one thing that many of the opponents of the University College used as an argument. These people at University College are taking our majors away from us. They're luring them out of engineering and putting them in something else.
I came in as a transfer student with 2 years of pre-engineering in, under my belt. And I was in here 2 semesters. Then I saw that this gave me the opportunity I needed to get away and do some searching, some soul searching. Mm-hmm. Because I had felt at John Carroll University in Cleveland, a very mm-hmm. fine Jesuit yeah. school, mm-hmm. that this wasn't for me. But I didn't know what to do with myself down there. There was no place to go. Someday I'll share with you how I got here, but that's another
story. Well, there are those who are firmly convinced to this day that we spent all our time undermining people who wanted to be majors in their areas. And it doesn't matter what the area is.
The research that I've read indicates just the opposite, that the kids coming in...
Of course, that was the truth of it. They'd get somebody who really made sense to them in a particular field, and they'd be drawn to that field as a major.
Yeah.
And most of the majors in English and history came out of ATL. They were stirred by the material, inspired, and they wanted to pursue it. But you couldn't tell people in English this. Mm-hmm. We're stealing their majors. We're sending them elsewhere. They would have registered as freshmen as English majors.
And we would have had more money and more professors.
We would have had more money, more professors.
Dr. Adams indicated that to me. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I'm amazed at in what I've heard today, because it really wasn't until today that I really has been focused in on Dr. Winder, that in essence he literally made that decision. Was there any, like, a public outcry of any sort?
There was, yes, there was a
and
pretty
how did
strong
he carry it on?
Public outcry, but, he presumably had Hardin's support. The board said nothing, you know, they didn't care.
Discussed at their meetings? I know that you have sunshine law here.
Now this violated all of the faculty governance procedures. It was supposed to be... would have supposed to have been discussed in various committees, and the committees then report to the faculty mm-hmm. council, and then the faculty council to the academic council, and the academic council should have decided.
Well, see, that's what I
thought. None of this was done. And of course, well, the trouble was, with Hardin as acting president, there was no place to go. You had a man who, well, this is none of my business, and if that's what Lee wants to do, it's all right with me. Hardin had no sense of procedures either. He paid no attention to the procedure. And of course, Ed Carlin was out and ill. I suspect if Ed had been in good health, then Lee wouldn't have gotten away with it.
Without a leader.
Warrington is a good guy, but he's not a fighter. And that was a fighter.
You needed a fighter. You needed a leader at the time.
Yeah, and that's what we didn't have. And of course, Warrington had no authority. What the hell's an acting dean?
What was Dr. Mackey's feelings when he found
was it like well, it was a fait accompli when Mackey came. And almost shortly after Mackey came, he got much of what he knew about what was going on here from Lee Winder. He listened to Winder, and that was a tragic mistake. Almost immediately after Mackey came, procedures were being put in place to do a number of things. One was to combine the 3 so-called core colleges, Arts and Letters, Social Science, and Natural Science, into one super college. And the 3 deans were all, 3 of them were approaching retirement, so presumably they would retire, and the new dean would go into place over the 3 of them. Well, there was a faculty outcry over that, and it was went through procedures and was voted down in the Academic Senate. Another thing that presumably Mackey wanted to do, I think this came from Winder too, was to remove tenure from being in place in the university to putting it in departments. Your tenure would be in the department rather than in the university, which means, of course, you get rid of the department, you get rid of the faculty at the same time.
Guess who I got an appointment with at 10:30 on Thursday? Dr. Winder. Dr. Mackey won't meet with me.
Is that right? Yeah. Well, he's pretty well. There were Mackey had bad luck and bad information. He came out as a vicious, the kind of vicious individual that he's not. He's a very nice guy, actually. But so much controversy stemmed from these kinds of things that Mackey is in a position like Herbert Hoover. Hoover's name was forever associated with the Depression. There's nothing that anybody can ever do to disassociate it. And Mackey's was associated with this turmoil, and there's nothing you can do about it. But anyway, the third thing then was, one major college, tenure in the departments, and then the third thing was to start getting rid of departments, make college leaner and meaner, the university. And if in the three colleges there would have been 34 or 35 departments, they wanted to cut that back to about 20 or 25. And of course, if tenure is in the departments and you cut departments, you're going to cut a lot of faculty if you want to do it. And one of the departments that was targeted was social science. The other one was now, it was humanities right away for abolishment. This is Lee's project continuing. Get rid of the college, then get rid of the departments, get rid of the people. Well, the outcry, the universal outcry across the campus is so great. And as I said, in the votes in the Academic Council, they were overwhelmingly defeated. At the same time, there was a proposal to go to the semester system. That too was overwhelmingly defeated in the Academic Senate. And they were very, very clearly votes of no confidence in Mackey. People, whether they really believed in what they were voting against or not, the turmoil was such that they were voting against the proposals because they saw them as Mackey's proposals. Well, anyway.
Yeah, that must be true because I understand semesters are going to come in now. Sorry to see that happen recently. I thought the quarter system was outstanding.
Well, I did too. I was sorry to see it go, and only one by one vote.
You're kidding.
One vote.
That close? Yeah. And they changed it?
And they changed it, yeah. Well, they had made up their mind they were going to change it. And of course, under the count of the ballots. But whoever did obviously was sympathetic to changing. But anyway, there was so much turmoil during those Mackey years, and I've always blamed Lee for a lot of it. I think a lot of this was his attempt to impose his ideas, mm-hmm. and Mackey unfortunately listened. And
when did Winder leave his proposal?
Oh, let's see. He left it about two or three years ago now.
Well, so he was in for quite a while after Mackey left.
Yeah, he stayed in there until he turned 65, and then David Scott, of course. Well, Scott is not sympathetic to general education. In fact, Scott doesn't know what it is. In fact, David Scott, I shouldn't say this, why not, may be the only provost at a major university in the United States who has never taught an American undergraduate. I'm not kidding. He's a product of the University of Edinburgh, in English and Scottish schools, and came here as a distinguished professor to run the cyclotron. And some graduate students, I don't know whether he did or not, but this spring term he was going to teach some physics course to undergraduates just to see what it was like.
I've heard there's some controversy about this integrated studies program he's trying to bring in.
Well, there's no focal point, there's no philosophy. Some of the people who are running it are, to be frank, cast-off specialists. They didn't make it in their specialty, so they're going to try something else.
That worries you for the school? That worries me for steak.
Well, it does. There's no. Well, actually, in the last 10 years or so, there's been no real concern from the top with undergraduate education. A lot of lip service, and this huge hullabaloo over the council the committee to review undergraduate education. And their agenda was clear. Their agenda is to make undergraduate education as cheap and efficient, but not necessarily effective, as possible. To minimize any kind of administrative structure, and of course to place control of undergraduate education to a great extent in the hands of people who really aren't interested in it, who are concerned with graduate education.
Don't they realize that that's where their alumni come from, that they pay the bucks in? It isn't these guys with masters and doctors.
No, of course not.
To keep the university
going. They're not concerned with that. And I don't know, they simply have lost, here you mentioned the land-grant philosophy earlier. They've lost sight of what this institution had come into existence to do. They lost sight of what Hannah had directed this institution in doing. They had lost sight of the fact that Michigan State is not, and given the University of Michigan down the road, will never be the major research university of the state. And that's what they want to do. They want to make another U of M in East Lansing, and it's not going to happen.
Well, see, the thing that I find happening here is the same thing that I see happening elsewhere. And if I'm wrong, please feel free to correct me. That people are equating too often elitism with quality.
Exactly.
And they are not the same thing.
They're not the same thing. And they're equating their particular specialty with the elite of the elitism. Mm-hmm. Everybody has to be just like me. Or they're not, somehow they're inferior beings.
I've seen where they do compare themselves to Michigan, whereas Hannah never did.
And because he didn't,
I've always felt it was a better school.
No, Hannah knew the difference. And now, every once in a while, you hear somebody mention the land-grant philosophy, but they don't know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. Now, Biagio did something that none of his predecessors did. When he came here, he went over to the archives and read all of John Hanna's speeches. And he learned a lot. He learned a lot. But he didn't, he got some bad information. And I think, too, he has, to a great extent, withdrawn himself from the day-to-day functioning of the university. He sees himself as a fundraiser and whatnot, and not as the chief academic officer, as he should be. And one thing that has happened in the administration building, too, is the growth of a horrendous bureaucracy.
That's the only
horrendous bureaucracy. Hannah was on top of everything that went on here. Wharton was pretty well in touch. Well, of course, Walter Adams knew everybody. He knew everything that was going on in every coffee room on campus. And Wharton made himself aware of these things, and Wharton was genuinely interested in the, as they say, in the intellectual life of the university, and that includes undergraduates. He wasn't concerned with turning out a bunch of specialists. He was interested in turning out educated human beings. And so he was very sympathetic to undergraduate education. And
I find that a contradiction in terms. An administration building dedicated to John Hanna. Because he ran things so lean and mean, and yet here they got this big bureaucracy type of building, and they named it after him. To me, that's an insult to the man.
Well,
that's like an example might be, and this is an over-dramatization of it, but that was like naming a whorehouse after Jesus Christ. I mean, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're right. Well, one thing they've done, too, you know, is how do you solve a problem? You throw another assistant provost at it. And we've got assistant provosts and assistants to the provosts and associate provosts coming out the ears in this campus. And of course, what they've done too, they've used this proliferation of administration to make what looks to be a good affirmative action record. If you make a new job and you appoint a woman or a black to it, this makes you look good on the affirmative action record.
I've always those who know me know that I am a, best way I can describe it is I'm a radical civil rights person. Now what I mean by that is I cannot stand racism of any kind, black or white. My feelings whenever I've seen people like Farrakhan or I've seen people like these hooded nuts down south is to line up against the wall and shoot them, because I can't stand racism. And quite frankly, I was up visiting a friend of mine, a brother of a friend of mine up in the Minority Affairs office, and I was insulted by the fact that the entire office was black.
If I were black,
I would be insulted, because if they had a office for Greek affairs and had only Greeks in there, I would be insulted as a Greek American.
Well, what they've done, this is exactly what they've done, you see. Yeah. They've used it to make themselves look good statistically,
yeah,
without any consideration whatsoever, whether it was good for the university or good for the minorities or good for women or good for anybody.
There's good people up there. They should
good
be
for
out,
the statistics.
They should be out there just like any other administrator would give any the same chances as any other administrator.
Well, so the result is you've got a bunch of these young people running around over there. Nobody knows what they do. They go to lots of meetings, yeah. I will say that for them. But it's most unfortunate, and it's part of this horrendous increase in the bureaucracy, and part of the isolation, consequently, of people like DiBiagio and David Scott and others who...
Yeah.
Now, John Catman still keeps his finger on things, and he's leaving now, you know.
Yeah.
Well, he should have been retired 2 years ago. But anyway, he's of the old school, who's concerned with what's going on. I see John.
Yeah, he seems very aware of it.
2-3 times a week, and we chat. But the others, he never see.
Yeah, he seemed very sharp and very on top of things. In fact, I made a comment to him just before I left that I couldn't grasp him retiring. I said, you know, it just doesn't seem right. But it's been interesting. Let me ask you this one of the questions, two more questions. And then we'll, you know, I appreciate the time you've given me. Question number one, the university model as you see it, is it the kind of model that could work with today's student?
I think so. Yes, I think so. I think it's more necessary, actually, than it was in the late 50s,
mm-hmm,
because our students have less general information now than they did 25 years ago. Of the kinds of things that are, I think, relevant to being an educated person. They know more about rock groups and the popular culture.
They are
much more part of the popular culture than kids were 25 years ago.
I shared this with Dr. Cantlin, and I would share it with you. The fault lies at the secondary school level, but it doesn't lie with people that everybody thinks it lies with. I've heard people say it's the teacher's fault, the principal's fault, it's the counselor's fault, it's the superintendent's fault. I subscribed to that until I got to where I'm at now. And now I know where the fault is. The fault lies, and I mean, I can clearly demonstrate it, that the fault lies with the fact that communities allow just anyone, for any reason, to become a board member.
I think you're right.
And these people come on the board.
Same thing with the board here.
And they have an axe to grind.
They
think that they know education because they've been a student. They don't realize that education is truly a profession. And they come on, and their attitude is, and most of them, unfortunately, come in with this attitude: I'm here to keep costs down. I don't give one damn about those kids. I had a board president get up at graduation and say to the kids, God's my witness, I want to thank you for the 12 years of entertainment that you gave me. And I saw jaws dropping in the front rows. I should make that comment. That's the kind of people that are in those boards.
Another thing about the peculiarity of education that always strikes me is that it's the only business in which the consumer wants to be cheated. If you give them what they need, what you know they need.
Well, it goes back to what Paul Dressel says. We must educate them to demand that we educate them.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to get into that. Mm-hmm. The other thing I would ask is, what would you if you were to take the university college model, what would you do to it to make it what you feel would be an ideal model?
Well, I think the first thing that I would do would be to restore an administrative structure, because general education is fragile and it needs a powerful administrative structure to protect it. You know, we have very good experience as to how easily it can be done in, how easily people can be played against each other in order to destroy it. And if Ed Carlin had been active in full command of his facilities, Ed would have fought him. But they
caught him at the right moment.
They got it at the right moment. And one of the techniques that some of the administrators, including Winder, used very frequently was joint appointments. You have your joint appointment in your basic college, and then that major thing. Well,
so divided loyalties.
Yeah, exactly. Except, of course, that he was using them as the carrot and the stick for a lot of people who were determined that they wanted to move over into the other areas. And so they were among those whose mouths, if nothing else, contributed to a consensus concerning things.
Was very sound.
I thought it was. Yeah.
The requirement that all the kids take it, or at least pass a test to get out of it, was sound. It needed what it had, which was an administrative unit separate from and unto itself, with good strong leadership. And then the final thing you needed was a person at the top who deeply believed and was committed to general education and education for undergraduates.
And people in the teaching department, so yeah. We're committed to yeah. a general education program.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's very important.
I've also heard several professors tell me, I'm trying to think who all, Dr. Thompson made this comment, Dr. Warrington made this comment, Dr. Hackle made this comment, that, and I can't remember who else, that the Harvard model is in many ways a hybrid of our university
yes,
college,
yeah. mm-hmm.
almost stolen from mm-hmm. our concept.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the whole thing yet. I've written to, I keep forgetting his name, but Dean Rosoky, Rososki or something like that.
Who I had it up here someplace. Yeah.
And I'm waiting to get the material from him, but I'll find that interesting. Because they're
well, it's funny that as other people were going in the direction of general education, just at the time that the powers that be were determined to do it in.
You know, it would really be funny if I could lay the two side by side and they almost mirrored each other. Because I just recently read an article in Newsweek that really told what a great general education model they had invented at Harvard. And being a land-grant person in my heart from day one, I would take great pleasure in zinging it to them.
In an editorial.
I'm going to shut this thing down here.